I like to tell people sometimes that I'm in charge of spare parts. But you know what? I will tell you that I view that role as being a thought partner to the CEO. My responsibilities are to help set the strategic direction for the hospital, to identify opportunities for growth and for service line development, for having to identify opportunities and strategies for physician alignment and payer alignment so that we can make it the most convenient place for physicians to practice, and that we can also be positioned in the market with respect to managed care and the insurance industry for patients and members of the community to come here without great inconvenience and to be financially able to come here based on their insurance plans.
This is Gavin Ward, co-host of Pop Health Podcast. In today's episode, I sat down with Cliff Daniels, Senior Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer at Methodist Hospital of Southern California. I first got to know Cliff through a volunteer role I held as part of the Senior Master Plan Advisory Committee member with the City of Temple City. I reached out to Cliff via email last year, and he responded right away, even though he was on vacation in Hawaii. And I got to know Cliff during that time and learned quite a bit about what the role of a chief strategy officer is all about. I think you'll enjoy today's show as you learn more about that role. And if you do, feel free to leave a review on Stitcher or iTunes. And if you have questions, feel free to reach out to me, gavin@pophealthpodcast.com. Thanks, everyone, and enjoy the show. Cliff, tell us something about you that would surprise the audience. Maybe something like a fun fact or a hobby, something outside of healthcare.
A fun fact outside of healthcare. All right. How about the fact that I actually played in the UCLA band when I was in high school?
You played in the UCLA band?
I marched and played in the band for football games, basketball games, and one of the concert bands before I drove a car, yes.
Wow.
So I grew up on the west side of LA. I went to high school on the west side of LA, and there was a we moved here from Northern California.
Okay.
They had great band programs in Northern California, but the high school in LA I was going to had like six drummers and a trumpet. There was no real band there. So my brother, who was 6 years older than me and was a senior, I guess, at UCLA at the time, said, "Why don't you play in the band at UCLA?" I said, yeah, right. So he actually introduced me to the band director there, and it was during football season. And it just so happened that the marching band marched in squads of four, and they only had seven tuba players.
Nice.
So they needed an eighth, and I remember I went and auditioned for the guy, and he said, it was a Wednesday, he said, "We rehearse tomorrow, 3 o'clock, be there." And from that day forward, I marched in the band at UCLA for 8 years, 3 years of high school and the 5 years when I was enrolled there. It's kind of cool.
Do you know of anyone else who was in high school that was in the UCLA band?
No, I think I was the only human that's ever done that. So
Guinness? Do you hear this, Guinness?
It was great. And it also, I mean, I met friends there. The band director became not just the band director, but a mentor for me. And one of the big reasons that I went to school there after high school as well. So
yeah, very good. Cool. So you're going to high school, went to UCLA. When you were going to school, were you thinking you'd get into healthcare, or tell us about that transition in your
career? I loved science and math, and I was actually a biochem major for over 2 years. And without going into great detail, I took this upper division organic chemistry class that I thought I failed when I walked out of the final. I got the only C+ I ever got in college, and I took the next quarter off. And I didn't take it to leave school, but I took Econ 101 and Poli Sci and English Lit and some other fourth class, and I learned something that it was the four easiest A's I ever got in my life. I kind of fell in love with economics, and that's what I ended up changing my major to, and that's what my degree's in.
Okay, so you finished college, you have a degree in economics. When did you end up in healthcare? Were you seeking it? Tell us about that transition.
You know, I've been in healthcare, working in healthcare my whole life. In high school, my first job was answering phones at a nurse's registry, and I did that all through college. Eventually managed a couple of the offices for him. And then when I graduated, my first job was as a bond underwriter for the insurance company in North America, underwriting financial guarantees for hospital companies.
Yeah.
And then from there, I moved back to Philadelphia and worked with a consulting group there that did some strategic planning and capital planning for large health insurance companies, some of the larger Blues plans.
Yeah.
Back on the East Coast and the Midwest. And then I met a professor at Wharton that enticed me to come back to the West Coast and work in the market planning group for a company called American Medical International, AMI, which owned 95 hospitals domestically here in the United States. So, and I've been in healthcare and hospitals ever since 1985 when I came back from Philadelphia.
Okay, nice. So a little over 30 years.
Yeah.
In the hospital industry.
Correct.
And tell us how you ended up here at Methodist Hospital here in Arcadia.
I was working out at the chief development officer at Desert Regional Medical Center in Palm Springs.
Yeah.
And I was contacted by a recruiter about this job. And I had known tangentially, Dan Osman, our CEO here, had just come to Methodist. And he had worked with Tenet before. Desert Regional is a Tenet hospital.
Yeah.
And he'd worked with Tenet before. And I'd met Dan very superficially years before and so knew of him. And so I took the recruiter up on his offer, came out and interviewed, and ended up coming to Methodist. It was the right thing to do at the right time because I was living in Rancho Cucamonga. I am living in Rancho Cucamonga. And commuting to Palm Springs each way was a 150-mile round-trip drive every day. And I wanted to get something closer to home. So Methodist is only 30 miles from my house.
Great. And tell the audience, many of whom are not from the Southern California area, where is Rancho Cucamonga in, and even here, Arcadia, in regards to maybe Los Angeles?
So Rancho is about 65 miles east of Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles. Arcadia is about 30, I guess, maybe 10, 15 miles east of downtown L.A. That math doesn't work out there, but maybe 20 miles. Anyway, Rancho Cucamonga is at the right about due north, about 8 miles due north of the Ontario Airport. So if you look at on a map, the interchange of the I-10 and the I-15, Rancho's about 5-6 miles north of there. And then if you go due west on the 10 or the 210, about 30 miles, you get to Arcadia.
There you go. Arcadia is a very special place for me as well. It's actually pretty much home, the home school district of my family and kids. And also Methodist Hospital here is our hospital of choice since I live so close. So for those of you out there that have been listening, now you know a little bit about where I'm from too. Okay, so you've been at Methodist 6 years. Methodist Hospital, it's not part of a chain. You mentioned Tenet Healthcare, which is a big health system. There's so many mergers and acquisitions, but Methodist is still on its own. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Let me tell you, first of all, I feel very fortunate to be able to work at a facility like Methodist. Methodist Hospital, Southern California, was founded in 1903 by the United Methodist Women in downtown Los Angeles, and it's been here in Arcadia since 1957. So it's been here a little over 60 years.
Wow.
In its current location. I would tell you that it is indeed an independent, not-for-profit, unaffiliated hospital. It is not part of a larger system like Tenet Healthcare owns, I think, 70 or 80 hospitals nationwide now. So it's a challenge for independent, not-for-profit hospitals to succeed in this world of healthcare today. But we've been very successful. Since Dan has been here since 2011, I came in early 2012, the hospital has achieved a record of quality and financial success I think that it's never had before. So we're recognized by Medicare as one of only 330 hospitals in the country with a 5-star rating. We've been recognized, and that's for overall hospital quality. We're recognized by the SafeCare Group, which is a fairly prestigious group that rates hospitals for patient safety and efficiency, as one of the top 100 hospitals in the country. We've received all sorts of other recognitions for providing safe care and high quality clinical services. So, and all that said, we do it in a manner that allows us to succeed financially, which is important because we're a business, although we're nonprofit, we're a business like any other, and you need to make money to continually reinvest in the business you're in, to continue to buy state-of-the-art technology, to accommodate, you know, the market needs of salaries for staff. So you know, we've positioned the hospital over the last 6-7 years or so to be ready for the future and to control our own destiny, which is very important as well.
So tell us about the different business units within the hospital.
The clinical services that we
yeah.
have? Sure. One thing that's important to note, as you alluded to, Methodist is a full-service hospital, so we deliver babies, like your family,
yep.
and we take care of people when they have emergencies. If you're out playing golf and you strain your shoulder, you fall off your bike, when you have a heart attack, God forbid, you can come here and the emergency room is open 24/7 with a full range of specialties available. We're designated by Los Angeles County as a heart attack receiving center. We're also just received a new designation just earlier this year from the County of Los Angeles as a comprehensive stroke center. So when you have a stroke in the field, if it's deemed serious, there's only, I think, 15 of such hospitals. There's 55 hospitals in LA County and only 15 hospitals have been designated as comprehensive stroke centers. Methodist is one of those. And so far as centers of excellence, we have a great orthopedic program. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the interview. We have a tremendous heart program, cardiovascular program. We've opened two outpatient institutes, the GYN Oncology Institute for Women with Cancer, and the what we're now calling our Institute for Surgical Specialties, which was originally known as the Colorectal Surgery Institute, where we have fellowship-trained colorectal surgeons. We have fellowship-trained vascular surgeons in there and an endovascular interventional radiologist who sees patients as well on an outpatient basis.
And when you say fellowship trained, what does that mean exactly?
When you go to be a doctor, you go to medical school for 4 years, then you'll do a residency in your specialty for 4 to 6 years.
Okay.
And then if you so choose to learn even more about your specialty, you can go and do a fellowship for 2 to 4 years after that.
So it's an advanced level, basically.
It's an advanced level of training within your specialty. So it's, okay. We have extraordinarily well-trained doctors in these clinics and on staff here at Methodist.
Great. So the role chief strategy officer, what does that mean exactly?
Well, that's interesting. I like to tell people sometimes that I'm in charge of spare parts. But you know what? I will tell you that I view that role as being a thought partner to the CEO. My responsibilities are to help set the strategic direction for the hospital, to identify opportunities for growth and for service line development, for having to identify opportunities and strategies for physician alignment and payer alignment, so that we can make it the most convenient place for physicians to practice, and that we can also be positioned in the market with respect to managed care and the insurance industry for patients and members of the community to come here without great inconvenience and to be financially able to come here based on their insurance plans.
Okay, so what does your staff look like with all those responsibilities?
Oh, it's a huge staff. It's a huge staff. I have 5 people that work with me. So,
okay.
And I'm the only one that's really responsible for the strategic planning and business development. I'm also responsible for the marketing and public relations functions here at the hospital.
Okay.
And for the community outreach functions as well. So that staff of 5 people is involved in helping me with community outreach, helping put together the marketing plans for the hospital. And we have our own director of creative services here. So we don't use an advertising agency. We have our own, like I say, a right-brained person here that develops all of our collateral, print collateral, and website design as well.
Okay, sounds good. So Cliff mentioned community outreach. One of the things about how Cliff and I first got connected, I serve on an advisory committee for the city of Temple City where I reside, and we're developing a master plan. So one thing that I was tasked with was to reach out to community healthcare leaders to interview them about what they think our senior master plan should look like, what healthcare resources are available. So I, to be upfront, Googled Methodist Hospital and some of the leadership and came across Cliff's information and shot him an email. And Cliff responded right away. And what was pretty neat was Cliff was in Hawaii on vacation, but snuck some emails in there. Hope the wife isn't listening.
Yeah, much of the dismay of the family, I'm always working, so.
Yeah, so Cliff responded right away and made himself available to the city of Temple City where I reside, and that's how we first got connected. So he touched on community outreach, and he's been and his team has made themselves available to our city, which is pretty neat. Value-based care is a term that's been thrown around a lot for good reason this decade. How would you say the terminology of value-based care and the changing landscape of reimbursement has shaped the future of Methodist, or where Methodist is going?
Let me help define value-based care, because that's a really fancy term that I don't think I even understand. But what that means is that the way our society is moving in how it pays for healthcare is moving from paying doctors and hospitals rather than paying for how much we do, how much work we do, to how well we do it. So we're getting paid for not the volume of work, but the quality of work, which is absolutely appropriate for healthcare.
Right.
Absolutely. And we believe, as I've mentioned, alluded to earlier, I think that Methodist has been successful as it has as a hospital because we're focused first and foremost on delivering the highest quality and safest patient care possible, not just on making money. So that said, we've tried to ride the wave, if you will, of being, what's the right word that they use in the technology,
Early adopters.
We participated in the bundled payments programs and value-based purchasing since the onset a few years ago. And to that end, what those alternative payment models are and what value-based purchasing is really all about is trying to focus on improving the quality of care while driving the cost of care down at the same time. And we've been very successful at that. It's forced us to collaborate even more with our doctors, which isn't typical in hospitals historically. And with our staff, our nursing staff, the frontline care deliverers, the technologists that have the best idea of how to do things most efficiently and in the best interest of patients. And in that regard, in focusing on trying to deliver higher quality care and lowering the cost of care, a lot of the payers, whether it's Medicare and sometimes some of the managed care plans, but mostly Medicare, the federal government has set incentives up where the cost savings can be shared with the hospitals and the doctors. So it's a win-win-win. Patients get better care. The government incurs lower costs, and people that are doing it are financially rewarded for making those efforts. So we view these alternative payment models as a way of the future, and I think a way that's going to help improve the quality of care on an ongoing basis for patients in the community.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of those bundled payments or value-based care initiatives by CMS or Medicare was the CJR program. I know that Methodist is opening a new orthopedic wing to the hospital.
Our joint and spine pavilion, yes.
Yeah, tell us about that.
So first of all, we don't participate in CJR. The Comprehensive Joint Replacement Program is a mandatory program in LA County.
Right.
It was instituted at the beginning of 2016, I believe. There was a program, a voluntary program before that called Bundle Payments for Care Improvement, BPCI. There's more acronyms in healthcare than any other place on the planet.
Yeah.
And we participated in BPCI since January of 2014.
Right.
And so by participating in that, we're exempted from CJR, just a nuance there. But
yeah,
as a result of our focus on delivering some of the highest quality joint replacement care in the community, we are indeed opening up a new joint and spine pavilion, a unit of the hospital. I think it's initially going to be 18 beds, and we'll have the ability to grow, expand it if we need to from there. And the idea is to care for those patients that come in here for elective joint replacement. The concept is that these patients are not sick. Usually it's an elective procedure. You're here because you want to improve your quality of life. You're an active golfer, biker, whatever, and you need a new joint for reasons of injury or arthritis. And, you know, when you come to the hospital, it's probably not the most enticing thought to be next to a cancer patient or a cardiac patient. So we're setting up a unit where only joint replacement patients and patients having elective back surgery, orthopedic patients, will be. And in fact, if we have my druthers here, you won't even be handing out hospital gowns. We'll give you a gym shorts and a t-shirt when you come in. The lengths of stay, we think we can shorten. We can provide standard of care and change or eliminate variations in care, which will improve and optimize outcomes, hopefully reduce the need for any readmissions within 30 days. And probably most importantly, enable people to be discharged home as opposed to discharged to a nursing home or a rehab hospital.
Yeah.
Because the literature says that you're discharged home, you have the best opportunity to, highest likelihood of recovering fully in the fastest fashion.
Absolutely. So can you walk us through the ideal scenario? Let's say I opt to have surgery here at Methodist for elective hip replacement. You mentioned shortening length of stay. What would my visit look like if I came in for a early morning surgery, let's say?
Well, first you would start with the appointment with your doctor who would prescribe that he would recommend surgery. And then we have pre-op classes that we would want you to go to, and education classes, and that teaches you how to get ready for the surgery, teaches you what the surgery is going to entail, teaches you what to expect while you're in the hospital for the short amount of time, and also what to do and what to expect when you're discharged out of the hospital, hopefully home.
Yeah.
And we view that those pre-op classes and pre-op education is incredibly important at a number of levels, particularly because it also reduces the comorbidity. So as you come to these classes and you may have high blood pressure, you may be overweight, you may be a smoker, you'll be incentivized and urged to try and reduce or eliminate some of those comorbidities, lose weight, stop smoking, get your blood pressure down, which enhances your ability to have a more favorable outcome from your surgery. I guess the better way to say that is it reduces the opportunities for complications from surgery. So you go to those pre-op classes, then you'll set the date of surgery will be set. You would come here and be admitted, hopefully have the surgery early in the morning, but the surgeons work all day long. The surgery is not a long procedure, usually lasts an hour or less.
Okay.
And you would be discharged from the recovery room to this unit, where on the day of surgery, hopefully we would have you standing up and walking. That's a goal. It sounds kind of amazing, but that's really what's taking place these days.
Okay.
And with that type of process and those care plans and pathways, we would hope you have it discharged within, 24 to 48 hours. Our lengths of stay for knee replacements now are, within 1.5 to 2.5 days.
What were they 10 years ago?
4 days.
Yeah.
5 days. But it's partly a pain management issue.
Okay.
Doctors and the pharmaceutical industry have made long, large strides in pain management with regards to post-op pain management. Now we're off, as everybody's well aware of, we're getting out of trying to reduce the use of opioids with regards to pain management, which is, I think, works on two levels. It's reducing the use of opioids and then post-op addiction, but also finding more effective means of pain management.
Yeah.
And enabling patients, as I mentioned, to get up and moving faster and get out of the hospital sooner.
Great. And then you mentioned, I know historically folks would go to skilled nursing afterwards or a specialized post-acute rehab facility. You mentioned the goal is to get them home. When folks do go home, would home health then be involved?
Oh, absolutely. The idea is that if you're discharged home, some people can't go home, and be just with a spouse or a partner or just family. They need extra assistance.
Yeah.
So if possible, you try and arrange those home health services to take place in the home,
yep.
as opposed to doing that in a skilled nursing facility or in a, an acute rehab hospital. Interesting fact is that Medicare spends more on post-acute, post-op discharge than it does on the hospital stay. And Medicare is looking, knowing that that's not even the most effective means of recovery.
Yeah.
It's, and it's cheaper to be home. We're looking for means of providing some of the services that might be received in a SNF or in an acute rehab facility to be done at home. So utilizing whether it's PT, OT, nutritional services, things of that nature to take place in the home, we try and arrange those and find ways to deliver those at the home setting rather than discharging people to SNF or to acute rehab.
Okay. Is there a name for the new wing?
We're going to call it the Joint and Spine Pavilion.
Okay, the Joint and Spine Pavilion. Opening up, it'll be open this spring here at Methodist.
Spring of 2018.
Yeah, awesome. I also know when we had lunch the other day, and even this morning, not just orthopedics are what you guys are really good at, but even touched on it already, the strokes. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned you have a specialist, a high-end or amazing specialist. Tell us about that.
We were very fortunate a couple, 3 years ago. It took me a year to find this doctor, and then it took me a year to convince him to come here. But we were very fortunate to recruit a physician by the name of K.C. Tan.
Okay.
And Dr. Tan is a very uniquely trained doctor. He's one of, I think, 50 or 53 doctors in the United States who is trained and fully trained both as in the neurointerventional radiology as well as vascular interventional radiology. So again, in lay terms, what that means is interventional radiology is a specialty that doctors can train and choose to learn and practice for the most part. And there's many interventional radiologists that are very well trained across the country. The vast majority of them are trained either as neurointerventionalists or as vascular body interventionalists. Think about it as neck up and neck and below the neck.
Yeah.
And usually the guys that practice neurointerventional radiology practice only from the neck up, and the guys that practice body or vascular IR practice only from the neck down. Casey does both. So we're fortunate to have someone here who is very well trained and able to pull clots out of people's heads when they have a stroke. Sorry if that's, I don't want to gross anybody out there.
Yeah.
But he's also able to help people with vascular needs. For example, he can embolize tumors. He can deliver with a catheter direct chemotherapy agents to liver tumors. He's done some amazing procedures. I'll tell you a quick story. A week or so after Casey got here, he's been here a very short time, an elderly gentleman in the community who was still, he was retired, I think he was 80 years old, still coaching Little League baseball.
Nice.
Was at practice with some 9 or 10-year-olds and was standing a little too close to the plate and took the full blunt force of a baseball bat to his belly and ruptured his spleen. So they brought him here. And the ER doctors called one of our general surgeons, and he had been bleeding internally so badly that his hemoglobin was very low. And the general surgeon said, well, you know, give him several units of blood, and when his hemoglobin comes back up, we'll take his spleen out. And fortunately, the ER doctor said, well, we have this new Dr. Tan here. Well, I'll call Dr. Tan. And Casey came in and said, you know, give him 2 units of blood. He came in, and he embolized a splenetic artery without having to take his spleen out. And the man was in the hospital for 1 day, went home next day with his spleen and fully recovered. Yeah. So it was a kind of a miraculous procedure. And I will tell you that I've watched Casey perform embolectomies where he's mechanically extracting the clot from the brains of people who have had strokes, who have come in completely disabled, unable to speak, unable to move, unable to respond. And I've watched them literally dance out the door to their car and go home and resume completely normal lives with zero deficiencies, neurodeficiencies. So it's a little short of miraculous what he does here for patients in the community. We're very fortunate to get him here, and we've been able to grow our stroke program and become a comprehensive stroke center, as I mentioned, because of his presence. And that said, you know, everything's a team effort.
Right.
And we have a team of neurologists on staff here who are called initially when a stroke patient presents. They will help diagnose with the ER doctors that it is a stroke. They will order the use of TPA, which is the clot-busting drug. And now the standard of care for stroke care is that even once you give TPA, if there's still a clot that's reachable and extractable, you go in and take it out and don't wait for the TPA. And that's what we do with Dr. Tan here. So it's a very robust program. It's not present at more than 15 hospitals in LA County right now.
Yeah.
And we're very fortunate to be able to provide it to the community.
Awesome, Cliff. Well, you've shared some great things about the Methodist Hospital here in Southern California. I've talked about the orthopedic wing that's opening up, Casey, and the stroke program that you have here. If you had a crystal ball in the next 5 to 10 years, what would Methodist look like?
Gavin, it's hard enough to predict 5 minutes from now in healthcare, let alone 5 years from now or 10 years. But a couple thoughts. I think that in 10 years' time, in the long-term future, this current management team and the board of directors wants to make sure that Methodist remains a full-service community resource for healthcare. which means that we would want to be able to still deliver babies, be offering emergency services, be a comprehensive stroke center and a heart attack receiving center for county EMS, offer all the broad range of cancer care that we provide and heart care as well. So again, remaining a full service hospital is one thing. I guess down the road in 5 or 10 years, I'd like to see the hospital more closely collaborating with or partner with some of the other hospitals in the Valley, maybe some of the physician networks in the Valley, so that we're able to continue to have that relationship where we're able to drive quality and partner, collaborate with them to help bend that cost curve. It's very important to keep that in mind. Reimbursement is not going up. We're not getting paid anymore, nor do we anticipate being paid more for what we do.
Yeah.
So the two ways of remaining viable from a business standpoint is to bring more business in and to grow market share, but also to bend the cost curve. And I think the way to do that, most importantly, and always maintain the idea of driving better quality all the time, is to collaborate more closely with physicians and the payers so that everybody's incented to do the right thing for the patient. That's the most important thing in healthcare, working collaboratively with the home health agencies to take care of people after they're discharged from the hospital. Just one quick nuance about these alternative payment models and bundled payment initiatives is that we're now being charged with responsibility for the patient after he leaves the hospital, or right. She.
Yeah.
So for 90 days post-discharge from the hospital, these bundled payments and these alternative payment models are saying, hospital, you are responsible for that care. We're being forced to, in a good way, work more collaboratively with home health agencies and SNFs and acute and other providers, subacute providers, to help coordinate care and identify who the highest quality providers of those care services are for when people are in the home, that we are able to not overspend and to make sure that we mitigate the need for readmission and that people's outcomes are optimized so they get back to their way of life as quickly as possible after an episode in the hospital.
Very good, Cliff. Well, appreciate your time this morning as Thank you. Recorded here in the San Gabriel Valley in Southern California. Cliff Daniels has been our guest. He's a chief strategy officer for Methodist Hospital with over 30 years of experience. Cliff, thanks for your service to the community and your availability to the show.
Oh, you're welcome, Gavin. Thank you for having me.
Take care.